School Leadership Podcast from NAHT Edge and NAHT.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the School Leadership Podcast, brought to you as ever by NAHT Edge and NAHT. This month, our podcast guest is Lewis Iwu, Director of the Fair Education Alliance. The FEA is an organisation that is working to tackle the achievement gap between the UK's most disadvantaged children and their peers. In a wide-ranging interview, Lewis talks about the FEA's views on grammar schools and where he sees the policy proposal going, the role of character education in schools, and also what it was like to have the outgoing Ofsted chief, Michael Wilshaw, as his former head teacher. We also have for you a secondary update in which we look at some of the issues currently affecting those working in the sector, including an update on Progress 8 and EBAC. NAHT Edge is delighted to announce that we have teamed up with CPD providers Focus Education to offer a range of courses aimed specifically at middle leaders in schools. Jointly branded, the courses will offer NAHT Edge members access to Focus Education's high-quality resources and support, and will provide practical solutions tailored to the particular challenges middle leaders face. To find out more about these courses or to book a place, visit the NAHT Edge homepage and click on CPD. The Fair Education Alliance was set up in 2014 with the goal of tackling educational inequality and building a fairer education for all by 2022. NAHT Edge Director James Bowen caught up with the Alliance's Director, Lewis Iwu, in their London headquarters and started by asking him to outline exactly what it was the organisation was trying to achieve.
So the Fair Education Alliance was set up 2 years ago, and it's a campaign that aims to, across five sort of buckets, close the education gap in sort of primary school, secondary school, in what we call sort of character, social and emotional well-being and mental health. The fourth area is NEETs, and the fifth one is university graduation. And by 2022, we want to work with our organisations and our partners, of which there are about now almost 80, to try and close all of those gaps. So we ultimately believe that no child's background should be an influence over their ability to succeed in education. We do three main activities, the first of which is we create a structure to allow organisations to collaborate more. So we have five working groups for each of those five areas. The second is we try and influence. So we try to come up with ideas that school leaders and policymakers can adopt to try and help us achieve those goals. And finally, we raise awareness. So we hold the nation and ourselves to account through a yearly report card, which we publish in the summer.
And the report card, is that something that people can access? Can they download that from our website?
Yeah, you can go on our website and you can view the report card. And it basically tells a story of where we are from our base year, which was 2012, to 2022. And, you know, if you read it, what we do is we break it down by area and by region as well. I guess the overall sort of story from our report card is there has been progress, but it's not anywhere near fast enough to help us reach our 2022 target. So in that document, we also make a series of recommendations that can hopefully accelerate progress. So they range from improving the early years workforce to and encouraging more people to go into that sector to improving the way we approach impartial careers advice in schools. And so it's an exercise that we undertake with all of our members. It's a document that is jointly created, which makes our life at the FEA interesting, because we've sort of got to sort of oversee that process. But it was one of the most exciting projects I've ever worked on last year, and we look forward to doing it again for 2017.
I'm really interested in the early years part of that. NHT, we have an early years council. We've been looking a lot around sort of qualifications and quality of the workforce. Is that about having qualified teachers in the early years? What's kind of the key focus?
Yes, it's about you know, having qualified teachers in what the way we phrased it is the most deprived early year settings in the country. And I think the first step, and Save the Children have done some excellent work on this, and they lead our work here, is to sort of helped revive the government's early years workforce strategy, which I think has been long promised but still hasn't materialised. But I think there's a real concern as well that if you're thinking about teaching, because of part the pay, early going into early years isn't as attractive as going into other parts of the profession. So there's both a question about how do we help sort of early years practitioners upskill, but also how do we attract people into that particular profession as well. And that's backed up by evidence. What we know is that the gap opens up early, and you know, by the time you sort of get into primary school or even secondary school, a lot of the problems that we see in terms of the ability to sort of read or to write or to communicate in part stem from our inability to sort of address those problems early on. So that's why we think the workforce is crucial.
Are you concerned about the lack of men working in the early years? It's something that we've spoken about at NHC a few times, that actually we'd like to see more men being encouraged to work in the early years. Does that form part of it? Is that something you've considered?
Do you know what? We actually haven't. That's really interesting. I think it has been discussed in our working group that looks at sort of early years. It's something that hasn't actually come out as strongly in our previous reports, but it's a really interesting area to explore. I know in general we've discussed in the context of primary school sort of there being a bit of an imbalance in terms of gender, and male role models are obviously crucial, but that's, you know, it's something that we should probably look more at in the future.
I can move us on a bit now. Yeah. One of the things that's really interesting for me is your organisation has been really quite strong right from the start in terms of its opposition to grammar schools, which is obviously one of the big debates going on at the moment.
Yeah.
Can you just outline for your organisation, what are your sort of main concerns about the policy?
Yeah. And just to be clear, you know, we don't have a position on existing grammar schools and whether or not they should be abolished. I guess that's a separate conversation. Our focus is on proposals to expand the number of selective schools. I mean, I think our concern comes from the fact that there is a clear evidence base that suggests to us that there is a pernicious effect of having more grammar schools in an area. Whether it's to do with sort of the ability to draw more resources, whether it's in terms of teachers, whether it's the psychological effect of selection and rejection at a particular age, you name it. The evidence from the EPI has a great report out. The IFS had a great report out as well this year, all showing that net social mobility would be harmed by this policy. And for us, given that we've got a clear time-sensitive campaign that we need to close these gaps by 2022, it's a big worry for us, because if we have a disruptive structural change like the introduction of grammar schools, that really does raise questions for our goals that we want to reach. I think there's also an added point to be made, and lots of our members make this point, which is, you know, it's a distraction, unfortunately. There's so much that needs to be sort of worked out, and we've touched on the teacher recruitment crisis. We've touched on the need to sort of really focus in on and ensure that every disadvantaged child has a good careers offer in schools. These are quite complicated problems that I think need a lot of attention and a lot of focus, and unfortunately, I think the grammar schools debate has been a bit of a distraction, and if it were to pass, would be a distraction as well. So for us, that's the basis of our concern. I will say this. It's great that we're actually having a debate about social mobility and the education system. I think it's been a blight on this country's claim to be one of opportunity and fairness, that so many people's lives are still determined by their parental background. I guess from the FEA's point of view, it's the right discussion to be having in terms of social mobility, but it's the wrong policy focus.
I'm quite interested in that. So is there anything, if you like, the government could do in terms of changing or watering down or amending the proposal that would make it perhaps more acceptable for you and your organisation? And if the answer to that is no, I think we've pretty touched on it. What is the alternative in terms of addressing social mobility?
That's a really good question. I mean, it's unlikely, and I don't want to sort of foreclose any potential option. Who knows what will happen after the consultation? But it's unlikely that there will be a workaround which would address, I think, some of the concerns that the evidence raises. I mean, even if you have a quota which has been discussed, and that quota is, let's say, sufficiently high, I think the EPI report sort of indicates that the benefit of actually attending grammar school diminishes, and the harmful effect on other surrounding schools which aren't selective actually increases. And then you're into a whole debate about, well, what's the point then? If you've got, because obviously the attainment, the inequality in the system means that you're probably going to have to sort of lower any sort of threshold requirement if you're going to have a quota that's going to be filled. So if you start to give differentiated offers and places in these schools, you're beginning to create something that looks very much like a comprehensive school in part. So I think I think it's unlikely that there'll be a workaround, but you know, we'll see what happens afterwards. I mean, in terms of what we'd say, I think we're very interested in opportunity areas, and we want to open a dialogue with government on that. And I know a number of our organisations who work in various parts of the country are interested in potentially working together in some of these opportunity areas. I think there's a real opportunity there to sort of get some real investment in and work with some of the leading practitioners to help raise attainment in some of the most disadvantaged areas. I mentioned some of the other policies earlier on. We, in our report card, when we talk about teacher recruitment, we think the government should think about making some serious investments in, for example, supporting teachers with mortgage deposits to get them into some areas. I mean, we have to, I think, be realistic that, you know, it's a false economy. If we don't have schools with good quality teachers, or teachers full stop, then there's going to be a economic cost to that. So, we get the argument back, that costs a lot of money. I think the frame should be, we're actually investing in getting the best teachers into areas where they're most needed, and making real investment, not token investment, I think pays dividends. And so I think that's one area that could be focused on. We're really interested, and I think we might talk about this later on, in the character agenda. My entry point to this is I helped set up a charity called DebateMate, which has been running for almost 9 years now. And the premise is that it goes into areas of high child poverty and it runs debate clubs. With the view of helping young people improve their confidence, their articulation, and also how they structure arguments in their head, which helps them with reading comprehension and their writing ability. I think it's a fantastic initiative, and there are lots of initiatives like that. And so I think making sure that schools have the space to be able to sort of embrace those types of programs, I think, also is a really good way of improving social mobility. If you look to, I don't necessarily like making comparisons to the independent sector all the time, but I think one of the things that they do in abundance is they give people the space to do those type of activities, and it pays off not just in terms of grades, but actually in terms of what jobs they get, university interviews, preparing them for life. So I think there's a whole range of things that we'd love to talk to the government about in terms of improving social mobility. But unfortunately, this has been a distraction.
There's a couple of arguments I'd like us to kind of address head on, if you like, because I think it's important that we do that.
Yeah.
There are supporters of grammar schools out there, of course there are, and they would point to that, and I think probably the government would point to it, saying that this is about offering more choice to parents, and it's also about giving a leg up to disadvantaged children who otherwise wouldn't have it. And I think we need to address those points head on. What would your response be to those?
I think parental choice is absolutely fine. I think the best way to improve parental choice is by ensuring that all comprehensive schools in the area are really good. I mean, I don't like to use personal stories in this debate, but I think it helps put this in context. I mean, I grew up in one of the most deprived parts of the country. We grew up in a council estate to immigrant parents. And because of the London Challenge and because of the investment in London and an excellent head teacher who happens to be the current head of Ofsted, the outgoing head of Ofsted, you know, my siblings and I went to an incredibly amazing school. The school down the road was really good as well. That's what gets parental choice in a comprehensive system where you work on getting great leaders in, great middle leaders in, great interventions from various charities in, and you get businesses to also get involved. I think that's a great blueprint, and we've seen it in other schools across the country, to ensure that there's parental choice. You speak to parents in London, where I think 90% of schools are outstanding or good. They would say that they have more choice than they did 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And I think that's the route. So I think the key thing about this debate is the frame. I don't think this is a... I think, you know, those who are sceptical of grammar schools shouldn't accept the frame that this is parental choice and standards for poor kids versus fairness. I actually think the way you get high standards, almost a grammar school type education without the selective bit and parental choice, is by continuing to do what we do, address the fact that there are still some problems. I think Ofsted's report yesterday pointed to the Northwest, to Manchester, Liverpool as areas where we still need to do a bit more work. But nevertheless, I think the trajectory is right. We just need to make sure we consolidate those gains.
And I think, you know, if one would say that funding is critical to that.
Absolutely.
The right funding. I mean, the London Challenge was very well funded.
Mm-hmm.
and that's part of its success. It doesn't explain its success entirely, of course. But
yeah.
But actually, we do need to fund other parts of the country appropriately as well if we're going to make that difference.
I mean, that's absolutely true. And again, you know, when we talk about, not to mention the dreaded B word, Brexit, but... if we are to punch above our weight internationally now and to go it alone, we'll see whether or not we have a hard or soft Brexit. You know, what happens in our schools becomes incredibly important. I mean, it's always been important, but even more so. And I mentioned the economic case earlier on. If we need to do more work to explain that, in effect, if we get the schooling bit right, we're paying twice, both one at school and then two, remedying the fact that we haven't done it right at school, whether it's through the welfare system or health care system or unfortunately crime. So I think the argument about investing in schools and sort of ensuring that schools aren't facing real terms cuts and there's a fair funding for schools, I think is one of investment.
So how do you see this playing out then? We sit here today and there's been a number of government policies that have sort of been U-turned or jettisoned for various reasons. Is this going to be another one of those? Or do you get a sense that actually in a year or so's time we will see new grammar schools arriving and expanding and what have you? Do you have any sense of where we're going to go with this?
I mean, I think the first thing is that, you know, having spoken to, you know, a wide range of stakeholders in education who've publicly come out against this policy or who've privately raised concerns, I think that will definitely have an effect. I mean, we had a survey which we worked with NEHT, Askell and Teach First on, a survey of over 2,500 teachers, and 85% oppose the policy. But it's not just them, it's sort of think tanks on the right of the political spectrum, think tanks on the left. It's a whole constellation of forces which I think have raised severe concerns about this. So I think that would create pause for thought, and we'll see what happens with the consultation. I think public opinion, I think, will turn. I think there'll probably be a couple of more polls coming out, maybe at the end of this year or the start of next year, which I think will show the public cooling. Obviously, depends on how you phrase the question, but that obviously will affect the ultimate policy. But I mean, one thing I personally think will play a big role here is the likelihood of a general election, and I think we're probably in even money territory in terms of whether or not there'll be an election or not. I mean, who betting on political outcomes I think hasn't been that fruitful for me this year, but I certainly think that a general election for a complete spanner in the works in terms of timetable, in terms of it then being in a manifesto and then potentially a government with an increased majority might feel more confident in pushing through a bolder form of the policy. And there are some powerful advocates within the Conservative Party for this as well. So I think there's so many variables at play. I think it's too early to tell. But I certainly think this is not a foregone conclusion. But I think we still have a long way to play.
And I want to finish by perhaps taking us away from grammar schools a bit. I think we've spoken at length about that.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier about the work FEA do in terms of character.
Yeah.
And you also know do work around sort of well-being, mental health. Mm. I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about your work in that area, what it is you're doing there.
Yeah, so our work, I mean, I guess the first thing to say is, for us, the sort of character, well-being and mental health goal that we have, impact goal that we have, isn't just a bolt-on, it actually underpins all of the other goals. So for us, it really is crucial. I think if you get that right, you begin to sort of address some of the problems we have in our education system. Our work is being led by Canterbury University and Family Links, and we have around the table a rich variety of organisations who come from the youth volunteering space, the mental health space, those who provide public speaking, coaching and training and debating. It's a really great group of organisations we have around the table. And I think we're trying to do a number of things. I think one of the first is we're trying to sort of help provide support to teachers and practitioners to help them explain this area a bit more. I think it's fair to say it could be a bit vague and nebulous at times. And I think one of the tasks of the group for a publication we'll be releasing next year is to sort of help explain the sector a bit more, disentangle what it means, and try to sort of create sort of a categorization of, you know, initiatives that are out there. And I think that hopefully will be really helpful to teachers to demystify character a bit. I think the second is measurement. So it's a really interesting debate about whether or not you can sort of measure character or resilience or the skills, but we're going to try and have a stab at doing it. And I know the EEF are doing some really interesting work on that too. And what we want to be in a position to do is we want to sort of be able to tell a story that either access to initiatives that help develop these traits sort of lacking compared to schools in wealthier areas, and we need to sort of address that, or that the skills themselves there is a difference if you look at sort of Hull compared to another more affluent area. And we're trying to get ourselves into a position where we can help tell a story, and that can help, you know, sort of influence schools, but actually most importantly government, in order to be able to respond to what that evidence or what that sort of measurement tells us. Finally, we want to create a repository, an online repository of all of free resources created by our organisations, again filtered by the type of skill set or the type of area that you want to focus on, because I think the feedback we've heard from teachers is that this area can be quite confusing, so anything to help streamline and bring together all that work into one space, one hub, is desirable. And we're hoping to potentially work with government on that as well. I know the DfE were planning on a similar thing. So that's what we're doing in the area. But I think, you know, above all, those are quite technical things we're doing. Above all, I think we want to be champions for this, because we can't forget the importance of sort of having, you know, strong mental health or access to be able to, you know, get help in schools. And I think provision isn't great. I think there have been lots of reports and statements recently saying that. But also help schools create the space where they can offer things like debating clubs to their young people, for example. It's very hard to do that if there are funding pressures, because these interventions aren't cheap.
And you mentioned lots of things, so like, you know, debating clubs, about the work you're trying to do in terms of having those online resources. Mm. If people listen today and think, actually, I want to find out more about the work you're doing, get access to some of these materials when they're there, what's the best way for them?
I mean, the best way is to sort of follow our Twitter feed, where we push out lots of content, and our website as well, where we actually have got lots of our organisations actually write about the work that they do and how it helps close the gap. So we're pushing out quite a lot of content over the next couple of months. Our website also has our report card, which talks about this in more detail, and there's also a collection of essays that we are publishing on the first week of December, one of which looks at sort of the measurements of character, social and emotional well-being and mental health, and asks whether or not PISA should be taking that into account in a much more robust way. So it's a really interesting, thought-provoking sort of essay that we have in there. So we've got a whole range of resources. And also, crucially, if anyone listening has any ideas or suggestions, we always look for feedback from people at the front line. Please drop us an email. There's a feedback button as well on our website.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.
Teaching. Leadership. And the latest developments in schools.
Next up, we have a secondary update for you in which Sarah Hannafin, one of NAHT's policy advisors, starts by trying to unpick exactly what Progress 8 and EBAC are and the kind of impact both are having in schools.
What are Progress 8 and EBAC designed to do? How exactly do they work?
Progress 8 is a secondary accountability measure. So what it does is measure the progress of pupils across a set of 8 subjects from the end of primary school to the end of secondary school. So it's a type of value-added measure. So pupils' results are compared to the results of other pupils with the same prior attainment. So it all feels a bit complicated. So that prior attainment is their key stage 2 results. And Progress 8 is introduced alongside something else called Attainment 8, and the two are linked together. The Progress 8 score is based on pupils' performance score across 8 subjects, and that performance score is the Attainment 8 score. So you have to understand them both to understand Progress 8. So what you have is a set of a suite of 8 subjects, and there's basically 3 buckets. So we call them buckets. So bucket 1 is English and maths only. Bucket 2 is students' 3 highest EBAC qualifications, obviously excluding maths and English. And bucket 3 is a student's highest point scores in any other 3 subjects. So it could be any other EBAC qualifications, other GCSEs or approved vocational qualifications. So students don't have to fill all 3 buckets. They don't have to have taken 8 qualifications. And sometimes the qualifications might not be approved qualifications that fit in the bucket. But if that's the case, they get 0 for that qualification. And obviously that's going to affect their progress score. So the aim is that really all students should be doing sort of 8 approved subjects. In terms of the EBAC, EBAC's interesting. There's some confusion and some people talk about EBAC as a qualification, but actually it is just a performance measure. And it's made up of English, maths, history or geography, the sciences, which includes computer science, and a modern foreign language. And the government's proposed aim is that 90% of pupils across the country would enter the EBAC. There was a consultation on it earlier this year. It closed at the end of January on some of their proposals. As yet, we haven't had a response, so we're still waiting to see where the government's going to go with EBAC. But some of the things they're looking at are increased accountability for secondary schools in terms of publishing the proportion of pupils that are entering EBAC, the proportion that achieve it in a school. So it all becomes a lot more important in terms of a school's performance data.
So what's the NAHT position on Progress 8 and EBAC?
So NAHT support the idea of a core academic curriculum for all pupils, but we don't think EBAC's the right tool to make that happen. It hasn't got enough flexibility to meet sort of the needs and aspirations and interests of all students. It's quite restricted. It's got a very narrow definition of what academic study is. And we think basically the Progress 8 measure offers a much better balance. We've obviously got some issues over the subjects that are included. We don't think they're the only ones that are academically rigorous and demanding. You know, at the moment, we're going through an extensive reform of Key Stage 4 qualifications where everything is being redone, new specifications, they're meeting much more demanding standards. And yet, the government's saying that some are more rigorous than others. Religious studies, music are just 2 examples of subjects that actually they are academic and they are rigorous, and we can't understand why they wouldn't be included in the EBAC. The other thing is that if students are studying the EBAC, realistically, that takes up sort of seven of their GCSE choices, which leaves very little room for them to choose anything else. And that can be a real, have a real impact on motivation of students and also their choices at Key Stage 5. Progress 8, we think, is a better balance. That's not to say there aren't some issues to be resolved with Progress 8, but it recognises English and Maths as being really important. It recognises sort of an academic core, if you like, because you have to then have three EBAC subjects. But then the third bucket of Progress 8 allows, it could be other EBAC subjects or other non-EBAC GCSEs or vocational qualifications. So it gives students that flexibility and that feeling that they've been able to choose what they want to study. It's right, if students want to study all of the EBAC subjects, then a school's curriculum should be designed so that those students can have the opportunity to do so. But we don't think that all students should be forced down that EBAC route.
We had the announcement last week that the idea of a Year 7 reset is to be scrapped. You must be very pleased with this.
Yeah, that was great news for our secondary members. We'd worked really hard to achieve this, and we're pleased, you know, that the government and Secretary of State did listen to reason and listen to what school leaders and teachers had to say and what their concerns were. It was a really flawed strategy with potentially significant negative impact on primary schools, on secondary schools, on teachers, on pupils. You know, pupils would be carrying this label that they'd failed their SATs. They'd have to be taught separately when they went to secondary school because they'd need a heavy diet in literacy and numeracy. And then they don't get that opportunity, that fresh start at secondary to explore other subjects and find new interests. And who takes it? Everyone that failed, you know, what about those that just failed by one mark? And then, you know, what happens next? You know, the idea of putting in another test isn't going to improve students' literacy and numeracy skills just by putting a test in place. What you need is high quality teaching and learning. You need really good strategies that have been evaluated so that everyone knows that they work, that can be shared across the country, that secondary schools can use, and adequate funding to make those strategies work for all pupils. So we're pleased that's sort of the way forward on this now, and it's not a reset.
And other than assessment, what are the other priorities for secondary members currently?
Adequate funding is a key concern for all schools, as is the recruitment and retention of good teachers. That's, you know, across the phases, and NHT is campaigning on both of those issues. I mentioned earlier, in addition, secondary providers are in a massive period of change with new GCSE, AS and A-level specifications, a new grading system at GCSE that everyone's got to get to grips with.
This month's featured course is on assessment in practice. It's a one-day course running in Birmingham on the 18th of January and London on the 18th of May. You'll develop the skills to lead outstanding assessment in your school and to support teachers in putting these skills into practice. You'll gain the knowledge to support teachers in understanding how each assessment method contributes to and builds on current practice to maximise the effectiveness of school improvement. That's Assessment in Practice on the 18th of January in Birmingham and the 18th of May in London. You can find out more on this and our other events at www.nht.org.uk/events. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of the School Leadership Podcast. All that remains for us to do is to wish you a happy and well-deserved Christmas holiday. We'll see you again in the new year with a whole host of new and exciting guests. NHT is a professional association and union for school leaders. NHT Edge is the part of our association aimed specifically at aspirational middle leaders. To discover more about the benefits of being an NHT Edge or NHT member, go online to nhtedge.org.uk/join or www.nht.org.uk/join. You can follow us on Twitter at NHT Edge and NHT News. We're also keen to hear from our members. And if you have any suggestions for guests you'd like to hear in a future episode or topics you'd like to have discussed, please get in touch via Twitter or email us at nhtedge@nht.org.uk.
This is the School Leadership Podcast.